Hi. Hi.
I'm going to hold it. Say something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, my name is Jeannie Aiko Mercer, and I'm the co-director of Shasta Taiko. Oh, okay. Okay. She wants you to say your name and your title.
Okay. My name is Russell Baba, and I am also co-director of Shasta Taiko and jazz musician.
Okay. Yes. Yes, that's true. Yes, I started in 1972 with the San Francisco Taiko Dojo. I had moved to San Francisco from Anchorage, Alaska in about 1969, and I had been observing the cherry blossom festivals in Nihonmachi. And of course, Taiko was one of the main attractions, and it was very thrilling to me because I've never seen, you know, a Japanese musical art form so dynamic. And but I didn't work up the nerve to actually join the group for a couple of years. And at the time, I was going to the San Francisco Art Institute. But the month that I graduated from the Art Institute is when I finally worked up the nerve to ask Tanaka-sensei if I could join Taiko Dojo. And one of the things that attracted me to it, besides it was, you know, so powerful and exciting, was the fact that there were very many, quite a few women in the group. And to me, you know, growing up in Alaska, I really didn't have much exposure to Japanese culture except for my family, really, you know, the food, and that was about it. There weren't too many traditions that we observed, except maybe for New Year's and, certain things. So anyway, to me, this was such a great opportunity to express myself. I was very much involved all through grade school and high school in classical Western music, and studying the piano. So to me, to see these women just going all out and being so physical and creating music at the same time was just very appealing to me. And so, the Taiko Dojo had, I don't know how many women. A lot of them were actually related to each other, you know, sisters. There was a mother and daughter. You know, I think it was, I don't know, about half and half at that time when I first joined. They were the first. The Taiko Dojo was the first group in America to form. And, absolutely. He's in about his 37th or 38th year now. Yeah, Tanaka-sensei was the founder of American Taiko. And so naturally, he's in America, and, you know, things are different here. I mean, in Japan, there weren't women participating in Taiko, except maybe for, you know, a couple of groups that were all women, like in Okinawa, for instance. There were a couple of groups that were all women, but generally the women didn't participate in Taiko along with the men. But here in America, it was, you know, a different story. There was no such restrictions. So I think the same appeal, applied to them as well as to me. It was just something so exciting and unusual. And also, besides, it was a Japanese art form. So anyway, Yes. I joined the group in 1972 in, I believe it was June. Well, no, I first saw it in about 1969 or so. Yeah, well, Russell had already, he had just joined the group in, I think, I believe in April or so of the of that same year, and so he was a beginner in the group when I joined, and that's how we met. And yeah, we pretty much have been together ever since then. We formed Shasta Taiko in 1984 unofficially. We actually moved to Mount Shasta in 83, and in 84 we started our own group. Mark Miyoshi, who's the foremost American Taiko maker, was living here in Mount Shasta, and so we all worked on this old whiskey barrel together to make a taiko. And so, yeah, so we had Mark Miyoshi, myself, Russell, and our son Masato, who was only about 5 at the time, and then our good friends, the Kamedas, Tadashi, Laura, and their 3 children, Shoji, Tommy, and Ayumi. Yumi was only about 2 at the time. So anyway, they're all little children, and we just practice together as a family. And then that was in 1984. And then the next year we got a received a grant from the California Arts Council as artists in residence. So then we started teaching taiko to the community, and that's how we officially started. We haven't kept track, but I would say a few hundred at least. Oh, the response has been really terrific. I mean, it's a small community and it's not a rich community, but we're kind of considered now a tradition, you might say, in our community. And we're able to put on yearly concerts, which are attended by, from 600 to 700 people, which is really unusual for such a small town. There's only about 3,500 people actually in Mount Shasta, so we do attract we have attracted a following, from Oregon and south of us, Redding, and even some people come from the Bay Area. So I would say we're pretty successful. But however, the finances are always tough, but that's I think that's true for everyone. But we do manage to survive here, and I think people really appreciate what we do. No, actually, there are very few Asians. So, although they're, we are increasingly seeing more and more. I don't know if they're tourists. I think some are actually moving here, but it's mostly white population. Well, there's about 3,500 within the city limits of Mount Shasta, and maybe 7,000 altogether. That's right. Well, we had the training from Tanaka Sensei, so he's, obviously he's from Japan, and he taught in a kind of a traditional way. He was a martial artist and involved in Japanese sports, so we had a very rigorous physical training, and we had to learn a little bit of Japanese. And so the martial arts training come, you learn the respect and discipline, that kind of thing. And so we're not as strict as he was, of course, but we do apply a lot of those principles in our teachings. So yeah, our students do get a little bit of Japanese culture in what we do, and just to be exposed to our performances and so forth. I think it's very educational, and we do workshops and demonstrations in schools in the area. Yeah, we do travel somewhat. We traveled up to Alaska. I think that's probably our kind of a favorite workshops and performances that we've done. It was in a small community, mostly with Alaskan natives. And it was just tremendous. I mean, it was really an exchange, because I think we probably got, you know, as much from them as they did from us. And they really connected with the taiko, because, you know, drumming is a very important part of their cultural heritage as well. Oh, it was amazing. I mean, like I say, that was a kind of a highlight of our experience. Yeah, well, actually, I was born in an internment camp in Minidoka, in Idaho, so I don't really remember anything of the experience. I mean, I have a few family photos from that time, but our family, I mean, my family, my grandparents, my grandfather, actually settled in Alaska in about 1915, so he was a real pioneer up there, and in those days, of course, there were hardly any Japanese whatsoever up there. Well, he had a hand laundry, and he had a restaurant, and then his sons took over and continued on with the laundry and dry cleaning business, which still exists up there. It became a big modern plant, and then one of my uncles opened a great Japanese restaurant there, and yeah, complete with the in Anchorage, yeah. So we were, you know, in the early days, our family was about the only Japanese in Anchorage. It was a fairly large extended family, but, you know, and then, of course, after the war, I think it's true of all Japanese Americans, we were just, you know, our parents, particularly the Nisei, you know, wanted us to be American, so we weren't really taught or exposed to really Japanese culture. Oh, yeah, it was kind of amazing thing. I mean, to this day, my family doesn't talk too much about it, but yeah, they were actually put on a ship to Seattle, and they were held, you know, at one of the what do you call them, the holding centers there. And then put on a train over to Idaho. And they actually, from what I've heard, they found somehow a Japanese Alaskan sourdoughs, you know, and really in the remote parts of Alaska, and drug them out of there. And they didn't even know a war was going on. So they were completely, you know, didn't know what was happening. And I mean, there's a lot of irony going on there, because like my second oldest uncle, for instance, was already in the army at that time. So he was stationed. My second oldest uncle was already in the army at that time, and he was stationed at the fort in Anchorage. And then his father, my grandfather, was arrested by the FBI and put into the stockade there. So it was, you know, that's one of the ironies, that his own son was, you know, literally guarding him. Yeah, so it was pretty amazing. But our family was, I think, luckier than some, for instance, Californian families who lost everything during the war, because, you know, our family was very prominent in Anchorage at the time. So when they came back, they pretty much got everything back intact. Yes, they did. Yes, I did. Well, no, not so much at the time. No, because, you know, there weren't too many of them living really right in Anchorage. And so, yeah. Yes. Well, it's kind of hard to explain, you know, unless you actually do taiko, but I think just just even as an audience member, when you first experience a taiko performance, and that first hit, you know, of the drum, it just goes right through you. It's something almost sort of primordial in a way. And I don't know, to me and a lot of others, we kind of feel, I don't know, we feel the call of our ancestors. We feel kind of a connection to nature spirits. You know, the taiko drums themselves are made out of, you know, wood and animal skins and air. So, yes, it's a kind of a very basic, I don't know, just a basic thing. And when you play the taiko, you try to connect with all those spirits. And well, you know, I wasn't really involved in those movements of those during the 60s because, you know, mainly because I grew up in Anchorage. And then when I came to San Francisco, I was going to art school. I was kind of insulated from all of that. I was just mainly interested in art, to be honest. But, you know, I was aware of all those things. And then when I joined taiko, it was mainly, you know, for, you might say, artistic reasons and very personal reasons, you know, as my personal expressions. But, yeah, I think the act of playing taiko is in itself sort of political in a way because, you know, you are educating people and, you know, we did perform for a lot of, and we still do, in fact, for things like pilgrimages, you know, to Tule Lake, for days of remembrance kind of things. And just to give demonstrations, you know, in schools to children, I think is very educational. And so in that way, I guess you could say it was political, but I wasn't involved in any kind of movements, you know, like during the 60s or 70s, per se. Yes. Yes, that's true. Well, I've been doing it for, 33 years now, so that says something, I think. I don't know, once you... Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, like now I'm considered a senior citizen, you might say. But, you know, I think taiko has kept me young and, you know, just being active like that and creative, I think, is very good for anybody. So, yeah, I'm going to continue to do taiko as long as I physically can. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks so much. Pardon? Oh, yeah, now I have to hold everything. Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah, I'll do it. I'll hold it. So here's Russell.
I'll sit over here. Okay. I hope so. Yeah, about 6 inches, yeah. Let me look at the thing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, very similar. I mean, the same year, maybe I had joined San Francisco Taiko Dojo maybe a month or two before Jeannie. And that was in 1972. Well, we met at the Taiko Dojo, so that's... well, Jeannie was there for about 10 years... And I was there intensely for about 3 or 4 years and then had an association with Tanaka Sensei, mainly through Jeannie, I guess, the remainder of the 6 more years until we moved up to Mount Shasta. With Jeannie? Yeah, right from the beginning, almost. Yeah. Right. Well, there's a, you know, there's a, I guess it's phenomenon where you have so many, there are many couples, I think, in Taiko couples. And, you know, even Portland, well, they did have Ann and Zach and Roy and PJ in San Jose. And there's a few others, Kenny and Chizuko. I mean, there, you name them. Actually, most of the prominent, at least American groups that I can think of, probably are, you know, started with the couples and supporting each other. And so that's, yeah, kind of a phenomenon about Taiko. I don't know why these couples, but it could be the time, you know, because I know during that time, you know, there was a lot of social things being brought up, and one of those things was equality, and you spread that over to not only between the races or nationalities, but, you know, also to women and men, you know, those kind of issues. So I think Taiko, in some ways, at least in my case, and also I think, and I can't speak for those other couples, but I think they're very supportive of each other. So in my case with Jeannie, I always encourage her to be creative, to take leadership roles, those kind of things. And, you know, and she had the capacity to do those things too. But it was a growing experience for everyone. Yeah, right. Well, I was born after the war in 1948, so during that climate, it wasn't popular to be Japanese, you know. After World War II, still, it had this kind of shame, you know. And even though my father was strong, you know, culturally in terms of being Japanese, our emphasis, and his emphasis also in our family, was to be more American and, you know, speak your English right. And I was raised by my grandmother when I was young, and I could speak nothing but Japanese, but I lost it all as soon as I went to school. And there was just certain, you know, I don't know, when things were made in Japan at that time, it was something cheap and tinny or something like that, you know, had that kind of, what do you call, reputation, yeah, stigma or reputation. And that led on to other things, you know, just growing up, you know, and seeing all the war movies constantly, and the Japanese were the enemy, and et cetera, et cetera. So that had done, you know, had maybe affected me and a whole generation of young people. You know, my stereotype of Japanese were that they were very quiet, didn't rock the boat, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I saw Taiko, or when I went to Japan and saw festivals there, or talked to, you know, Japanese nationals, they weren't shy and, you know, quiet. They were loud, and in some ways they were loud and told you their opinions. But, of course, that's part of Japanese culture, too, is also being somewhat, what do you call it? Not quiet, but reserved. Yeah, it's over the top kind of thing, you know. Yeah. So there are outlets there. In American culture, maybe we have football games or something where you can get drunk and go yell in the stands, you know. But that's the kind of culture that I was missing, and it was a, you know, some kind of suppression or something was wrong. And in terms of trying to be a creative, expressive musician, you know, I had troubles getting over that hump. And it was just like flicking on a switch. I mean, you flicked it on, and I could be, I could learn to be more bold, especially in the music field where I felt more comfortable. Yes, I mean, of course, it's very free. Basically, I taught myself. It was on passion and desire, and I was good enough to attract good musicians to me who and older musicians who you know were like teachers, and well, I played. My main mentors, I would suppose, are drummer Eddie Moore and violinist Michael White and pianist Andrew Hill. And those three, I met, you know, of course, a lot of other musicians through them and just being around. But I would say those three plus another musician named Gerald Oshita, who was Japanese-American, and also he had influenced me. A saxophone, I play saxophone and, flutes, woodwinds. I started about, let's see, about 70, oh, no, about 68, maybe. Well, I mean, you could call it jazz, but I didn't know what I was playing. I mean, it was improvisational music and I was teaching myself. So wherever I could, I played with rock bands or more freer players who were just playing to be creative. And in jazz, in the jazz world, there is, you know, improvisation. So I gravitated toward that kind of music. Plus, during that time, there was music that was, you know, social change, that kind of music, and in that freedom and expression in jazz, maybe through John Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, those type of players, that I found a similar expression of creativity plus social comment. Well, it can be. I mean, and it is used that way. I mean, for me, when I play, it that says everything. You just hit the drum, and it's like I'm drumming in your face. It's like, yeah, this is who I am. This is my color. This is what I look like. This is what I'm playing, and, you know, et cetera. So to me, it answered a lot of let's see, things in myself about politics. Before I was awakened, you know, because of the Vietnam War and of course, the the movements at that time, the Black movement and the Asian movement, et cetera, political movements. And I was a student, so I was a student activist and things like that. But I felt very, I was lost in terms, but I was open. And, you know, it helped to open me up in terms of expressing myself and questioning what direction I was going. So when I found music, I didn't feel comfortable in the political arena. I didn't feel true to myself sometimes. And I could see people being swayed, you know, here and there just because of a speaker, et cetera, et cetera. Or because of the times, and what I found truth was in music, and I felt comfortable there, so that's when I started to explore music, and like I said, I taught myself, and then I had reached a certain point. Maybe I had been playing 5 or 6 years, and then that's when I saw Tycho, and then I decided to join Tycho and explore some of, you know, like Japanese culture. And my Japanese Americanness. Well, yeah, it does, and but it answers on a lot of levels. I mean, like Jeannie referred to before, drumming is real primitive, and also it's like, you know, it's a root back to the earth, and also those kind of activities. I mean, it's so, you know, basically it's, when you look at it, it's simple. You have a drum, you have a stick, and you're hitting it. So that's kind of a rebellion against all the computer technology and all those kind of things too. So I was also feeling that way, you know, and so it answered a lot of questions for me, and it helped ground me, not only in my my own culture and who, you know, my ancestors are, but also to the earth and those kind of things. Yes, I mean, it helped build my self-esteem. I think before then, I had low self-esteem as a child because of the reasons I told you before. And so discovering myself in music helped me up to that point. And then when I took Taiko, it helped even reinforce the cultural aspect, you know, my own ancestors' background. So, but, you know, there are other things, you know, when I play, yes, I am representing Japan or Japanese Taiko, but also I have to be true to myself. I'm Japanese American or Asian American, and I have a totally different experience. So sometimes I find a little difficulty in terms of I really don't have the freedom as an artist, not always. I mean, I'll fit the mold, you know. If somebody wants Japanese drumming, we'll go and do it. And I usually understand that. I mean, if I go to a school performance, let's say, I'll, you know, I won't bring out the saxophone. I don't have enough time. That's another issue, too. But, you know, let's say we play 45 minutes. And I know the reason they're asking us is they're, 'cause they want to see Japanese drumming. And then I have to talk about the roots of Japanese drumming, which is from Japan, and talk about, you know, that, which I only know intellectually. And then I try to, if I have enough time, I try to relate to the children about Asian American experiences and why we are playing. I don't really know. I mean, it's a rural tradition, so. And I believe it probably came from China, because I've seen pictures of Chinese drums, and they have very similar drums. And, you know, China was the central kingdom, and Japan was a satellite. Yeah, well, there are, you know, there are, what do you call it, mythology, you know. But it has its roots in the rural tradition, and I think it has something to do with communication too, because a big drum can carry far, and so, you know, perhaps in villages and stuff, when they play the drum, it could signal certain things to the villagers. If they're out in the field, let's say, and you needed to meet, you know, maybe that the drum could carry that far, and also in war. But it also took, you know, I mean, essentially, I think it was also a spiritual thing. Well, for us, we look at the drum as being, it was once a living, the materials were living. So once again, the root back to the earth, you know, the body itself is made out of wood and a tree. And the skin is made from an animal. So so when we play the drum, we bring these materials back to life, or we bring the drum back to life, and they speak in another way. And so that's what we believe. I mean, that's what I like about it. I mean, like I said, it's just so simple. Wood, skin, a wooden stick, and a human being. And then what's so beautiful is that you put your whole spirit into it, you know, once you get trained. And a lot of people have a hard time, you know, jumping into that kind of spirit I mean, not everybody can be a football player and lay it all out on the line. You know, we don't have that kind of, you know, outlet in our everyday lives, or most people. So with taiko, I mean, you can force yourself to physically and spiritually, mentally, you know, really give it your all. And that's what's so beautiful about it for me. Yes, it's about music and things, but there's for me, a little deeper level. And what I've experienced in taiko, especially in big groups or many groups together and a lot of people together, playing together, it takes on a more of a event than the music itself. I don't know how to explain it. Maybe it's the closest thing that I can get to. Like in Japan, they have big festivals where thousands of people are participating or hundreds of people are participating. And we don't get that here. So when I perform with a lot of people, it takes on that kind of frenzy or kind of a, you know, you lose yourself. You lose your ego in a certain way. You don't even know where you are. I mean, almost you create this thing. And that's what I liked about it. And that's what I learned from Tanaka Sensei. He would hold these grand concerts and et cetera. And a lot of people participating. Didn't matter what level you were. It was all inclusive in terms of the people playing taiko. And you reach a kind of another place, which is nice, just for a moment. You know, you lose who I am, the Russell Baba jazz musician or whatever, you know. So it's refreshing. Oh, I'll just keep playing until I can't play anymore. It's been so much. Once you get it in your blood, it's really hard to give up. When we first moved up to Mount Shasta, we had actually made a conscious choice of not playing taiko. And but the taiko maker was here, Mark Miyoshi, so it was just a fit. And when we saw our children, we wanted to give them something. When Jeannie and I moved up here, it's a rural area. And so, but we had the confidence and sophistication of our previous lives. So what we brought up here, I wasn't threatened by, I'm going to lose it or something. I had something to offer. And so when I saw the children here, especially our family, you know, my son and Shoji Kameda and our neighbors, Ayumi and Tommy, you know, it was like a calling. And we decided to teach taiko to them because we know how much it meant to us. And with Masato, our son, and Shoji, our taiko son, we received confirmation because they're taking taiko to other levels. I mean, they're still continue to play. They take it serious. They have been taught by other teachers, have gone to Japan, and are creating their own music using taiko. So, you know, that of course helps us. And we know that helped their own self-esteem. And they're very, you know, they're very confident, yet very humble and very open. So, it's a great thing to see. We still struggle here, you know, Jeannie and I, because we're in this situation. If we were moved to a more urban situation, probably we may have a little easier time. But we realize that drumming and that kind of activity is essential in any community. And especially here, when I see so many people hurting, I mean, that's my own interpretation, that they're searching for something, and when they find something like taiko or something that can ground them or some kind of a purpose in their life or some activity that they can do, you know, it really makes a difference in any person's life. Yeah. Let me see. Is it still running? Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, you could email me those instructions. What it says here on this thing is to take the disc out of the machine. Oh, okay. Okay. Do you want me to check it right now and make sure it's running? And you want to hang on? Okay, hold line. Okay, I'm going to stop this right then. Okay.